So let's turn to our distinguished guest. He is a graduate of Antioch College and the University of Chicago, and he now is a professor at the very renowned McGill University in Canada. In informal talk and certainly not boasting, he let me know that it was recently selected as one of the 12 most outstanding universities in the entire world. Mr. Saltzman is going to discuss with us today his new book, Culture and Conflict in the Middle East. We had hoped, as we often do, to have some copies for your purchase and for signature, but it turns out that they're a little late in arriving, and therefore we will, at the conclusion of the talk, take your book orders. And I know it is a book you're going to want to read, and after you hear from Philip Saltzman, I think that desire will be even strengthened. There was an excerpt from the book in the most recent issue of the Middle East Quarterly, and some of you may have seen it then. The book actually traces features of Islam, such as jihad or honor killings, things which we read about in the paper all the time, and traces it back to ancient tribal notions of kinship, and he looks at this in a historic context. Mr. Saltzman is an anthropologist by trade and has done a lot of ethnographic field work in the Middle East, in Iran, in India, and has lived among tribes, I believe, in Baluchistan, which he may be telling us about. He published a prior book back in 2000, Smithsonian Press, called Black Tents of Baluchistan. So without further ado, it's really a pleasure, and I asked you to give a warm welcome to our speaker, Philip Saltzman.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Levin, for that very nice introduction. I was boasting about McGill, actually. And I'd like to thank the forum. I'd like to thank the forum and Daniel Pipes for inviting me and giving attention to my new book and my ideas, some of which I'll try and share with you today. A little bit later, I'm also going to share with you some pictures from my friends in the Middle East. I'll explain a little more about that in a moment. Let's begin, if we may, by imagining that all of us in this room are no longer in a high-rise in Philadelphia, but are in a desert in the Middle East. And we no longer can depend on our law clients for our income, but we have, each of our little families has a few camels, some sheep and goats, some wheat and barley seed to plant if the opportunity arises, and we have to make a life there. What do? We look at each other and we wonder, I don't know all of these people. What are they going to do? What am I going to do? Basically, there are three possible options for living together in that setting. One is, I say, oh, that fellow looks scrawny and weak. I'll bet I can take his camels and his wife and his children. On the other hand, that guy over there looks very brawny, and I wonder if he's going to take my camels and my wife and my children. That's called the war of all against all. And you don't have to think very far to decide that maybe Thomas Hobbes was right in saying that that choice leads to a life that's short and brutal and nasty. Another option is to look around and say, well, I see some people who look brawny, and I see some people who seem to know what they're doing. Maybe if we ask them, they'll take charge, and they'll organize things. And we can find a way ahead with this leadership. But there's a difficulty with that as well, a difficulty that Plato pointed out. It's nice to have guardians taking care of you. But who guards the guardians? Who protects you from the guardians if they try to exploit you? If they try and take your things and push you around? The third option is that we come together and we speak together and we say, look, we're better off if we all work together. We can defend one another. We can stand together. We can help one another. We can define ourselves as a group and be all for one and one for all. That option is the tribal option. That's what tribes are. They're groups that have taken on political responsibility for themselves, where all the members are more or less equal, and where each is responsible for every other, and each will step up to help every other. And this is what you have in the tribes in the Middle East. Now, there's another aspect to the story, two other aspects. One other aspect is that on the other side of the hill, there's another group like us. Now, what's going to happen with that group? With our collectivity, with the strength of our working together, we can go and propose an alliance with that group. An alliance to defend each other against outsiders. One's more distant. And so local groups can connect with other local groups to form a regional tribe. And the yet other aspect of it is that we've heard that there is far away somebody who calls himself a king who says we belong to him. Our land belongs to him. Our livestock belongs to him. Our children belong to him. To take in his army, to take as a wife. And we say, we're not buying that guy. We don't want that guy coming. We don't want his tax collectors. We stand on our own. We're free. We don't pay taxes. We don't take orders. And if those folks start coming this way, either we join with the guys on the other side of the hill and fight them off, or we climb on our camels and we ride the other way. That too is the tribal option. The tribe is an independent polity that avoids falling under the aegis of an exploitive state. And I'm sure you all remember that prior to modern times, states were always exploitive. That rulers ruled for their own benefit, not for the benefit of the people. And I fear in many Middle Eastern countries, the story continues that way today. Now, I'm going to show you some slides, some pictures of the place that I did research, not in the Arab world. I'm going to talk a lot about the Arab world. We're just across the Gulf from the Arab world in Iranian Baluchistan on the Iran-Pakistan border. These people are called the Yarahmadzai tribe, the descendants of Yarahmad. Also, once the Persians came, they took the name Shahnawazi, which means Shah Stroker, as part of the deal. When they became semi-independent and the king of Iran Reza Shah established some control over them. When I went there, they were part of Iran, but operating to a large extent independently. They're not Arabs, but their tribal organization is exactly like Bedouin. And I'm going to talk to you quite a bit about Bedouin and the impact of Bedouin on the Arab world today. Okay, now, if you'll hit the button, we'll get that slideshow started. It will come in a moment. Now, of course, tribes are not formed.
They're moving.
Yes, yeah. Tribes are not formed usually by people, strangers coming together and making a compact. English political philosophers like to think about that, but they usually develop using a kinship idiom, and they think about themselves as descendants of a common ancestor through the male line. They're patrilineal kin groups. And they define loyalty in terms of closeness of kinship. A basic principle is you always combine with closer relatives against more distant in any conflict. And so a family will stand against a family, but combine with them against another lineage. And that lineage and your lineage will combine against someone from another clan. And you together will all combine in relation to somebody from another tribal section. And the tribal sections will combine, and the whole tribe will stand against outsiders from a different tribe. So there's a balanced opposition there. But people always think and always must think of themselves as a member of a group, and they always must define themselves as a member of that group in opposition to anyone more distant. Group loyalty is absolutely critical to the culture, and it's the basic principle of political organization. In general, decisions are made collectively by the adult members of the group, and particularly the men, although they always hear from the women. And all the men are warriors. All the men will act as warriors in a tribe. And that's one of the ways in which equality is maintained, by all the men being warriors. And the tools of coercion are distributed evenly throughout the group, so that it's never the case that someone has a weapon and someone else doesn't have a weapon. Now, within a tribe, among kin groups, conflict does not always lead to further conflict or escalation, because mediation is a very important element. Mediation is a lubrication of the political process. And the highest esteem that anyone can have in the Middle East is through successful mediation. When you hear, in the Arab world particularly, about sheikhs, a sheikh is not a ruler. He's not a boss. He's someone who's been successful at mediating. No sheikh can tell anyone what to do, but he can convince a lot of people what to do, and that's why he has high status. Now, the other side of this is that if you're solidary with members of your group and can form alliances with closely related groups, much more distant groups have no claim on your loyalty or your kindness or your consideration. In fact, groups beyond your tribe are open to your predation. They are targets for you. You can go and steal their sheep and goats. You can rustle their camels. You can attack their caravans. You can carry off their valuables. And indeed, one of the main sports among Bedouin tribes is raiding for camels, raiding other tribes for camels. And one of the main ways that a young man can make a name for himself is to go raiding, capture a bunch of camels, and then distribute them to his kinsmen. Nobody accumulates wealth in this kind of society. There's no point in it. More camels is just more work. You want to invest in your fellow tribes members, so you distribute everything you can spare. The investment is in your fellow tribesmen and their loyalty and their support. And it was very common for tribes to compete with one another, tribes to fight with one another, and Bedouin tribes everywhere would fight for land, would fight for resources, would fight for livestock, and some were driven out of pasture areas and settled down to become peasants. Many in North Africa, many Bedouin tribes in Libya, for example, were lost and were driven into Egypt and settled down in the Nile Valley to live as peasants. So many people who became settled have Bedouin backgrounds. And of course, the tribes always viewed states the same way they viewed outsiders. States were predatory organizations looking to exploit them, and I think that was quite accurate. Now, Islam arose in northern Arabia. Who lived in northern Arabia? Tribes, Bedouin tribes. Muhammad's first recruits, his congregation, were all Bedouin. All the followers of Muhammad were Bedouin. His army was a Bedouin army. What does that mean for Islam? It means that Islam was built on the Bedouin structure, on the tribal structure, on the oppositional structure. It couldn't have been any other way. How else could you have convinced the tribesmen to accept Islam unless it accepted the basic structure that people lived with? And the opposition in the tribal system is reflected in Islam by the opposition between believers and infidels. And that same opposition, that same sense of no rights for the opposition also exists in Islam. This time, however, validated by God, no less. And Muhammad integrated the Bedouin tribes, brought them together at a higher level of integration as Muslims, and turned all the fighting that they've been doing with each other outward. And as they say, the rest is history. Very quickly, the Bedouin tribes conquered the Levant, they conquered Iran, they conquered northern India, they conquered North Africa, southern Spain, Sicily. Finally, at the far edges, were stopped barely by military mobilization, but quite an amazing feat for a bunch of tribesmen who not very long before that were fighting each other in northern Arabia. But this opposition continues in Islam between the believers and the infidels. And there's a very strong sense, in my view, among Muslims, and particularly among Arabs, of course, that they are the chosen people. Allah chose the Arabs. Allah's language is Arabic, as you can see in the Quran. And anybody who is not a Muslim, who doesn't convert, is rejecting God's will. And it's the duty of Muslims to advance. That was Mullah Rustam, the mullah of our camp, the religious leader. And that's me on the right in my Bellucci drag. It's the obligation of Muslims to advance God's will, of course, and advance God's control over the world. And anybody that does not accept God's word, well, what stunted thinking, what corrupt people they must be to willfully reject God's will as conveyed in the Quran. I believe this is the thought, this is the position of Muslims, and particularly Arabs, who originated Islam. Now, what does this mean today? How is this relevant in today's world? I propose that you see that opposite, that tribal oppositionalism in all the Arab states today. And a particularly obvious example is when you take the oppressive government away, all of those oppositions break out into war of one group against another group. Does that sound familiar? Is that what happened when Saddam Hussein was removed? Shia and Sunni fighting one another. Now, there is a break. Interestingly, this great division in Islam between Sunni and Shiite, a division that we see, of course, in Christianity and Protestantism and Catholicism, Shiism and Sunnism, such strong opposition that many view the other group as a worse threat than infidels. These two groups arose, where did they arise from? Two close kin groups, both related to Muhammad. I'll tell you specifically. Muhammad's son-in-law Ali and his sons were of Muhammad's father's brother's children's line, and the Shiites follow them. Muhammad's son-in-law Muawiyah of Muhammad's great-grandfather's brother's line was Sunni, and these two religious orientations have each selected a different tribal principle. The Shiites have selected dissent, in this case dissent from Muhammad, for the choice of the leader of Islam, and the Sunnis chose consent, the consent of the community, for the leadership of Islam. So you have two close local lineages in conflict over leadership of Islam. One chooses one tribal principle, the other chooses the other, and now the Islamic world is divided between these two. And you've seen the conflict in Iraq between the minority Sunnis, who under Saddam Hussein had oppressed and murdered many of the majority Shiites, and now with Saddam Hussein gone, the government in the hands of the Shiites, the fear on the part of the Sunnis that they're going to lose that they're going to get from the Shiites what they gave to the Shiites, and many Shiites not all that sympathetic to the Sunnis. So you also have that oppositionalism at the lower level within Islam, and then at the highest level between Muslim believers and infidels. Finally, I would say that for tribesmen always, independence, equality, autonomy are critical values. And there's another aspect to it, and that is that how do you get people in a group like this? It's a good size lineage. You get a group like this, how do you get people to set aside their short-term individual interests, their short-term family interests, in favor of the large group, the collective long-term interests? How do I get you to give up your family's camels to pay off a blood debt, to make your contribution? How do I get you to step up and say, our lineage mate was injured, we're going to go and fight the other lineage, rather than say, let them do it. There are two answers. One is, and this was made clear to me by my Baluchi friends whenever it came up, the only people you can depend on in the world to help you is your lineage or your kinsmen. No one else will help you. The second thing is, there's an ingenious cultural institution that was invented to get people to do their duty, and it's called honor. If you do your duty, you will be viewed as an honorable man by your fellows. If you don't do your duty, they will view you as shameful. So your standing among your fellows depends on your willingness to step up and do your duty to the lineage. But honor in that sense exists in an egalitarian kin tribal group. And what they don't accept is to take orders from someone else. Therefore, in the Arab world, they're really is no legitimate political authority above the collectivity. Because all tribesmen, all kinsmen are in principle equal. Arabs are much more egalitarian than we are, and you might say that they take it to a fault, because they accept no hierarchy, no authority above themselves. But you see the implications of this. There can be no legitimate state. They will not accept a state. They will not accept direction from a president or a government. And so if there is going to be a state, it can only take one form: a tyranny that imposes itself on the people and oppresses them with coercion. And that's what you see in every Arab country. It's not because Arabs don't love equality or don't love good citizenship. It's because they don't accept hierarchical government authority. And that arises because of the conflict between the tribal concept and the concept of the state. Now, the unfortunate consequence is, with this tribal framework, with this oppositional framework, it's impossible to build a civil society based on inclusion. There is no obvious way to step from loyalty to a group to loyalty to a constitution or a regime of law and order. People are committed to their group, not to a rule. They're committed to winning, not to conforming to the law. And so, in these countries, you have people loyal to their groups, ready to fight other groups. And I think, again, we've seen this in Iraq at every turn, where the government pressure was taken off. And the impossibility of generating a civil society which will include all different groups on the same legal basis. And why don't I stop there and you can ask questions.
Bob is going to run this.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe we'll put the lights on.
Okay, thank you very much.
You want to put lights
Before I start, let me thank Lori Levin and Pepper Hamilton for their hospitality today. And Murray mentioned that one of the programs of the Middle East Forum was a defense project, a legal defense project. And Pepper Hamilton, as it turns out, has an excellent team of defamation lawyers to defend the First Amendment. They're representing the Inquirer, Daily News, and other well-known media outlets. So at some time, perhaps, we may even call on some of Murray's colleagues to help us out. And I just wanted to, by way of, before I ask to begin the Q&A, Daniel Pipes remarked on Mr. Saltzman's book that he fell in love with it. Well, if you know Daniel, this is an unusual turn of phrase. And what struck me, I read the article in the Middle East Forum and Mr. Saltzman's presentation today. He does not look on his subjects as ants on an anthill. You can see that he has bonded and has sympathy without using his critical analytical abilities. So the first question, yes, Robert.
My question is this. A lot of the Bedouin have moved into cities. The question is, how do they keep up the tribal affiliations? Is it by neighborhood now, or how does it work?
Certainly in a lot of places where Bedouin have moved into cities, they've moved into compact communities, and the political process is exactly the same. I have actually a chapter in which I just drawing on the research of an Israeli anthropologist, a series of case studies of Bedouin who have settled in on the outskirts. I believe it's, if I remember correctly, it's Tel Aviv. And you see this exact competition and opposition in action among the settled Bedouin. They're in jobs. They live in houses. They have regular jobs, and they're competing by they're parking big trucks in front of their houses, and other earth-moving equipment, and so on. There are new ways to express the opposition and to challenge your opposing group, but it still goes on that way. And what I would add is that that this framework, this way of looking at things, has been absorbed into the general culture of the Arab Middle East. This framework doesn't, the assumptions about group loyalty, about honor, don't change even when people have been hundreds of years away from being nomads and from the tents. That framework exists, and I think you can, we've been reading about Baghdad, and it's a little astounding. I mean, in Baghdad, everyone was walking around with automatic rifles. People were fighting between neighborhoods. The neighborhoods are blocked off. There's cleansing in the neighborhoods where they're mixed neighborhoods. Whoever was the minority would flee. The Shia, if it was a Shia minority, they'd flee to a Shia area. So all of this was at work in Baghdad. It's one of the oldest cities in the world. But the process is still the same. Otherwise, I mean, how can you explain what went on in these places without, other than by this framework of group loyalty and opposition?
Yes, ma'am.
This tribal loyalty sounds very much like the American Indian. They had their own tribes, they fought one another, they stole horses from other tribes.
Yes, I think, I mean, there have been tribal groups all over the world, and in Africa, of course, it still continues in Africa, and I'm afraid we're seeing some of it right now in Kenya, and of course it existed when Hungarians first came to Europe. They were organized into tribes. The Germans were organized into tribes. The Mongols. I mean, tribes are very widespread. They're not all organized in exactly the same way. Turkish tribes were organized slightly differently because there was a seniority and juniority principle in Turkish tribes, which meant that they accepted the authority of the senior. That's one of the things that allowed the Ottoman Turks to establish the Ottoman Empire and to conquer the Arabs, because they were able to establish a legitimate authority amongst themselves and therefore to organize in a more solidary way than the Arabs were. The Arabs were always fighting each other. And so that's how the Ottoman Turks succeeded in establishing the empire and gaining control over the Arabs, who were always incredibly incensed to see the Turks take away the control of the Middle East and take away the leadership of Islam from them, who it truly belonged to, as they saw it.
Alex?
Mr. Salton, you seem to be ignoring the influence of the Quran.
What do you have in mind in particular?
That is the end all for everything that they do, the Quran.
Well, my point was that Islam and the Quran have incorporated this tribal oppositionalism that I described in it, and therefore when one holds to the views of the Quran and to the commentators, one plays out that opposition, specifically between believers and infidels. So I see Islam and the Quran as reflecting this framework of thought and of political thought.
Can we just move Earl?
Yes, to the extent that the Western culture is different from this tribal option, what do we do with the 21st century? I mean, this is all very interesting, but what does it mean to us in view of the fact that it appears that we have a huge enemy with this culture trying to either convert us or get us to become what they are, or to destroy us? What does it mean to us in the West?
Well, I think the first critical thing is we cannot assume that they think the way we do. They have a different framework. They have a different set of assumptions, different goals, and are compelled in different ways than we are. Our brave soldiers have gone out and said, we will fight, we want to stay alive, but we will take the risk for our duty. But they don't go out and they say, oh, I want to go out and explode myself and then I'll go directly to heaven. There's a real difference there.
So what do we do?
Well, I think we have to recognize what that difference is and decide that we can't say, well, if we're only nice enough, they'll decide to treat with us and we'll be friendly from then on and we can all live together happily. That's not the way it's going to be. You first have to recognize the reality and base your plans on that. Partly what you do, anything you do is always risky, and there are different possible political routes to take, and I think maybe different people would favor different things. But unless you base it on the reality of what people are like, you're certainly going to get it wrong.
Jerry Boris. It's over to you.
Well, actually, I'm glad you illustrated the diversity in the Arab Muslim world, because it goes to the heart of this fraud called the peace process, which is presented dishonestly as two minuscule people fighting over one tiny piece of land, when it's really the microscopic Israel against the entire Arab Muslim world. And because that entire Arab Muslim world is really going to have plenty to say about what happens in the Middle East, as they do now, it's going to be impossible for Israel to make peace with just one little group of so-called Palestinians.
And the question is, would that be your view?
That would be my view.
Dave?
I wonder if you could, apply your theories to the surge. Specifically, you know, the U.S. failure in the aftermath of the invasion of Iraq in the initial years, and then with the Petraeus strategy of working with the tribes, that seems to have been a successful approach. Is it a reflection of the theories you've espoused? And then I'd come back to Beryl's question, where do we go from here?
Okay, your first question is a very gentle, easy pitch, which I will...
wasn't intentional, but I'm happy to do it.
Look, we went in, I mean, the idea was, we got rid of this awful regime, and we thought, okay, everybody's going to be really happy, and then they're going to get together and make nice. Well, they didn't make nice. They jumped at each other's throats. And that's exactly what I think we have to expect in that setting. In a sense, I think the increased success of American attempts to pacify Iraq is a result of a big mistake that Al-Qaeda made. Al-Qaeda was sending in outsiders, and these outsiders didn't pay sufficient attention to local organization. They don't know who the Iraqis are. They go into a town, they're just a bunch of folks. They don't know anything about them, and they had the guns, and they were from outside, and they pushed them around. And they didn't know that they were tribes. And so the local guys said, wait a minute. You know, we don't like these foreigners here. And we don't like the Shiites. But these guys are coming in and taking our houses and raping our women and taking away our honor. We're not going to put up with that. And they started fighting them. And when the Americans started seeing that the tribes were not accepting Al-Qaeda, somebody was smart enough to say, oh, hey, guys, we're on the same side. You didn't know that, but we're on the same side. And the Sunni tribe said, oh, yeah, okay, give us some guns, give us some money. And so, yes, they saw that... the tribes were viable and they were serious, and they did turn out to be on the principle of your enemy's enemy is your friend. They turned out to be our friend, which Sunni tribes had not prior to that. Daniel yesterday made a good point when we were discussing this. He said that if you look at two of the great colonial empires, the colonial systems, you can contrast the French and the British. The French like to go in and impose French civilization and try to incorporate a colony into its civilization. The British followed a principle of indirect rule. They go in, they find out what the local organization is, they hook up with the leaders of that, and they work through the indigenous organization. And he's saying, in the Middle East, you don't have enough compatibility between the West and the folks there to establish the kind of government that reflects yours. You've got to go in and work with the local structure. And what does that mean in Iraq? It means go in and work with the tribes. You know, they talk, they have cities and they have governments and this and that. That doesn't mean they don't have tribes. There are real tribes on the ground, and all the rest of the people think like tribesmen anyway.
Let me just ask a question. John Bolton spoke last night about Iran and nuclear weapons. How would your analysis apply to Iran itself and its view towards the United States, and particularly what happens if this viewpoint has a nuclear weapon?
Okay. Iran is a somewhat different story because it never was a tribal society. It's surrounded by tribal societies, the Turkmen and the Kurds and the Baluch and the Qashqai and so on. But the heart of Iranian civilization is a peasant and urban. It's an ancient peasant and urban civilization. It was an empire 4,000 years ago, and a great empire. And so Iran is not the same. In fact, during the beginning of the Islamic invasion of Iran, they said, "You're a kid. These bunch of nomads, these bunch of Bedouin ragtag know-nothings are gonna conquer us." Well, they made the wrong military judgment, but they looked down on these ignoramuses, these illiterate ignoramuses, because Persian culture was high culture, was very well developed, literate, art, and so on and so forth. So you do not have the same tribal civilization. But what you do get is, you get Islam, which has incorporated that tribal opposition. So on the ground, in everyday life, in the structure of society, you don't get the tribal organization. But at the highest level of integration with Islam, you get it. It was borrowed. It came in with the Arabs. But they've got it now, and it seems critically compelling for them. What do I advise we do about dealing with radical Islam? Invite me again, I'll give you another call.
We'll do that. Let me ask the last question go out.
I'd like to go back to the question of the future, even though you kind of pushed it aside there, but going back also to something that you referenced here. You mentioned to someone over here Germanic tribes, the Magyars, other tribes in our common past. I don't know what their exact structure was. I don't know if that's too far afield from your particular anthropological studies. But I would guess that they had a similar tribal imperative going on over there. And yet somehow, over time, Goths became Germans, and Visigoths became Spaniards, and a rule of law and civil society managed to be imposed upon a people who entered the scene in a similar fashion. Do you feel that there is something inherently flawed, and I'll use that term purposefully, within the Arab mind that will keep it from ever living under the rule of law? Or are we perhaps seeing now the beginnings of that transformation from Visigoth to Spaniard, from a tribal world to one where actually a rule of law can possibly apply? Is there a kind of possibility?
Yeah, I don't think that the tribal system is a flaw. I think it was the best choice under the circumstances of most of history. The transition that you mentioned, I think you pick a good example, because there have been about 2,000 years of transformation from the Roman Empire and all of these tribes that came in and so on, through feudalism, mercantile society, the development of capitalism, the Enlightenment. It took a long time to transform the tribal structures of Europe to the kind of society that we're familiar with. One of the things that's advantageous in Europe is that it's possible to have stable settlements without sacrificing your well-being or your production. You're dealing with a different environmental zone in the Middle East, and so sedentary society has always been more problematical there. So much of it is desert. And so much of it is not very productive. So the transition to a more feudal system is inhibited by that. But also, I think even today we have a largely tribal mentality. If it takes 2,000 years to get out of that, we've got quite a bit of waiting to do. And how you jump. Can you jump phases? I'm not sure that we have examples of jumping. If maybe an instructive example is the Ottoman Empire, where you had people coming in as tribes, then with a somewhat different culture that allowed them to accept authority. Then you had the consolidation of the state through the replacement of tribal organization by slave armies and slave administrators, and then the settlement of a lot of tribal peoples. But again, in Anatolia, which is a much which is not a desert region, so an easier place to do that, and that only took 1,000 years, and now you have Turkey that's considerably more modern and more viable than the Arab countries that are present today. So if you look at that example, you can see that it is possible to do something, but the conditions are more difficult in the Arab world, and it hasn't happened in the Arab world.
Thank you very much. I guess maybe we just want to ask one more question.
Doesn't some of that transition, Ottomans and all the other, take strong men leading? In other words, you need a strong man, which is what we destroyed in Iraq, even though it was a bad strong man. He was holding it, Iraq, he was holding it together with his strength.
The difference was that there was a legitimate basis for the Ottoman Sultanate. The Turks accepted that as legitimate because of their seniority principle. There is no such principle that legitimizes a state in the Arab world. So it takes strong men, yes, but strong men don't become legitimate. They just become more oppressive, more tyrannical, and since they have no loyalty, inherent loyalty from the people, what do? They look to the outside and they say, everything that's wrong here is the fault of guess who?
You just
commented that the strong man doesn't have legitimacy. Could you tell me, does that also apply to the
Saudi kingdom, that those, that despite their being the keepers of the holy places, that the Saudi rulers have not had legitimacy over the past 200
years? There are a couple of things about that. One is that the Saudis are really a lot more tribal than other governments. They operate in a more tribal way. They're themselves a huge family. It's not just a couple of guys, and they very quickly brought in as many people as they could. Many of, for example, the Almora tribe and other tribes were hired immediately as members of the National Guard. So every tribesman, every tent got a retainer to be a member of the National Guard. The other thing that they've done that's very smart is to draw on religious legitimacy. So however dicey their legitimacy is as rulers, they have this alliance. They came in with the Wahhabis right from the very beginning, and they share power with the Wahhabi religious establishment, which has managed to maintain a significant amount of legitimacy because they're not directly in government. So they have a lot of influence over the government, but they're not ruling, and therefore their legitimacy doesn't disappear. So they're drawing on it. If you look at the actual operations of the Saudi government, anybody can come and talk to any of the government, can talk to the king. I mean, they have open forums, people come in and talk to him. It's very like a tribal sheikh or a tribal chiefdom writ large. And remember, they're not collecting taxes. This is a petroleum state. They're handing out stuff. So the issue of legitimacy is less pressing when you're handing stuff out rather than taking stuff from people.
Right.
So no, that will be that, and we have to end. Thank you very much for this very different perspective.